Happy 15th birthday to Google, the future of Google Plus, Hangouts Big Bug, the Galaxy Gear smartwatch, and more. All this coming up next on This Week in Google.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 218, recorded October 2nd, 2013. Show Bill the Gates.
This Week in Google is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Go to LegalZoom.com for affordable legal solutions you can trust. LegalZoom's not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction or speak to a legal plan attorney to get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the promo code TWIG to get $10 off at checkout. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIG10.
This is TWIG, This Week in Google, the news show that covers all the stories about Google, the cloud, Chrome, Android, Facebook, Twitter, publicness, privacy, and any topic really related to that. I'm Gina Trapani, and I'm filling in for Leo, who's taking a much-deserved vacation. But fear not, he'll be back next week, back into the big chair. Actually, Mr. Jeff Jarvis, who's usually my co-host, isn't here either today. He couldn't make it. So the reason why I'm not freaking out, though, too badly, is because I've got amazing panel here. In studio, we've got Mr. Aaron Newcomb, host of Floss Weekly here on the TWiT Network.
Hey, Gina.
Hey, thank you so much for being here today and holding down the fort in Petaluma with Chad.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime.
Yeah, appreciate that. You're a frequent guest and co-host on All About Android and Twig, and it's very comforting to have someone I know well in the chair there on the table. So thank you.
You bet. Anytime.
And on Skype, we've got our fantastic guest today, Mike Elgin.
Hello, Gina. I know that Jeff is not here today, so I will try to complain about Verizon as much as I can in his absence.
Please do. We need that. We need that. Yes. Mike is a freelance tech writer, Google Plus user extraordinaire, and just generally great guy. Love to talk tech with both of you. So thank you so much both for being here. I guess we should just dive right down into it. I think the big story this week is that Google turned 15 years old, which for an internet company is absolutely ancient. They held a press event at the original garage where the company started, which I guess they celebrate the birthday on the 27th of September, but it's that day is kind of shifted around. It's not clear what day they actually, you know, filed as a corporation. But they held this event back in the original garage and announced a few updates to search and to their PageRank algorithm. They announced Hummingbird, which is their new kind of search algorithm following caffeine, which I guess has been out for like a month now. No one's really noticed. And to celebrate, they changed the Google Doodle and the Google homepage to the original 1998 version. And if you missed it, like I did, you can actually Google in 1998 to see what that looked like.
Well, you know, Gina, you were probably in middle school when Google came out, but I actually remember it very well. And at the time, the hot search engine was Alta Vista.
Mm-hmm.
Just was the greatest search engine ever, Alta Vista. And this Google thing came out, and it was a research project. And it was like you had to be such a dork and nerd to even know that Google existed in the first, you know, this is before the IPO and stuff like that. And, you know, if I recall the paper that they wrote, engine project, was actually also available on the site originally. So you could read Sergey and Larry's sort of philosophy about PageRank and all that kind of stuff. But I actually remember when, before the IPO, and I remember trying it out, and it was like, wow, this is pretty good, even then.
Yeah. I don't remember when I first started using Google, but I do remember the time when if you use Google, you were smart and savvy. Like it was the filter that you used, you know. Yeah, I'm not even remember how I came about it. I was just finishing college at that time, so I was not in middle school, just to be clear, in 1998.
I was
probably using Mosaic at the time.
Yeah, I was out of college, but I was using Yahoo as my primary search engine at that point. You know, Yahoo was real big. Everything that Yahoo was doing looked great. And then Google came out, and I was like, oh, how do you spell that again? You know, and by the time I got it in the browser and pulled it up, like, I never turned back. It was just like all Google from then on because it worked so well and it was so simple to use. You know, interestingly, it hasn't changed too much in the way it looks.
It's true.
Yeah. You would think, I mean, if you look at the history of other companies like AOL or Yahoo or, you know, any of those companies, they've gone through major, major changes in the way they look. But if you look at Google, they've kept it simple and they've kept it looking, even though the features and functionality have changed over time, they've kept the look and feel very basic, very clean. And it's simple and it's easy to use. So, I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Is that a good thing? I think it's a good thing. What do you guys think?
Well, they dropped the exclamation point, unlike Yahoo. So I've taken Yahoo a little long to do that. It's pretty amazing that the company never went through a major pivot. I think that it was either Paige or Brin who said the original idea was to make a system so that people could order pizza online without kind of leaving their house, and that had somehow given way to search. But yeah, it's pretty amazing that it's always been a white page with an input box that returned
documents. To me, the most impressive thing that they've retained is the I'm feeling lucky button.
Yeah.
That's just a goofy sort of, you know, nobody's paying attention kind of thing that a geek would throw up there and just put a button, just, you know, roll the dice on your search engine. And it's still there.
Yep.
You know, this is a multi-gazillion dollar company and they still offer I'm feeling lucky.
I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, it speaks to their initial bravado, if you will. You know, they had done so much testing and they say, look, this really works better than anything else. We're going to put this button there. And it's still there today. It kind of speaks for the solidity or the integrity of the search engine itself to say, you know what, every time you go to do a search, you know, you hit I'm feeling lucky more times than not, you're going to get to the page you want to get to. So I think that speaks volumes to Google's ethos and the way that they develop their products for the most part.
Yeah, and it's not just the existence of a button that will take you to their best guess. It's the language on the button that is so informal and so kind of just casual, colloquial speech. And you hover your mouse pointer over the button, it'll say, I'm feeling hungry and all this other stuff. It's such a wonderful homage to their origins, and it's nice that it's still there. I also think it's worth pointing out that as part of their celebrations, they rolled out the new quote-unquote flat design for the logo, for the logo. And I think it looks fantastic. It looks great. It looks very consistent with their company-wide design look and feel. And I think it's fascinating that Yahoo did this huge contest and like they made a big deal about their redesign thing. And they came out, they ended up with a logo that looks like 1998.
Yeah.
With the drop shadow. And I remember in the 90s, like those drop shadows and sort of the 3D looking. That was what was happening. And that became obsolete like 10 years ago. And it's just shocking that after all of that, they came out with such an antiquated looking typography and logo. Whereas Google looks, you know, they retained the colors and the idea of the original logo, but they've just flattened it and made it 2013. I really like it.
Yeah, and it's interesting now to look at Google and, you know, what they are now as a company. They're a huge company. They've got billions of dollars in the bank. They've got this set of core products and this huge business in advertising with lots of money in the bank. And in a way, they're sort of turning themselves into this like moonshot company who's trying, you know, big audacious things like, you know, self-driving cars and Project Loon and Glass. But if you rewind to 15 years ago, like their original mission, you know, which is to, I guess, to organize the world's information. I think that's the phrase, to organize all the world's information. Like that was a huge moonshot. You know, back then that just seemed insane. And especially as the web was just exploding, you know, not only did Google have to make a search engine to find everything that already existed in the web, but it had to grow at the rate at which the web was growing. And then, of course, with books and things, you see them, you know, scanning. So it's, you know, and maps. And I mean, it just exploded. I mean, it just, you know, of course, it was a talented team and a cohesive vision. But it's just something really magical. Not to sound like a total fangirl, although I guess this is the show to do it on. Is something magical happened with this company, and a lot of things went right. I mean, certainly a lot of things gone wrong, but more things went right, that's for sure.
Well, one of the, you know, this whole moonshot concept, I think, is very key to the company. Everything, even the stuff that isn't a moonshot, is a moonshot. When you, you know, when you read about, you know, in the Plex and some of these other books about the internal meetings that they have at Google, the way they go is somebody says, you know, we should sort of take a picture of everybody's house in Mountain View, and Larry, we're going to picture of everybody's house in the world. We're going to, you know, every time there's an idea, it's like, let's do this ridiculously large version of that idea. And then they do it. And that's really what Google is all about. They're just about massive thinking, like really, really big thinking. And that's I think been a key to their success.
Don't you guys think that's, it seems like they not lost it, but it seems like that they kind of declined in that aspect, the moonshot aspect, until, you know, Larry came on as, do you guys agree? I mean, it seems like with Larry now, everything's like, okay, let's focus on these core things and then come up with this subset of really big ideas like Google Glass and some other ones, right? And self-driving cars.
Well, I think they've jettisoned the little ideas. For example, Google Reader, which I think was a huge mistake for them to get rid of, specifically because some of the heaviest users are influencers. So I think it's a bad PR move for them to get rid of Reader. They should just sustain it forever, because the kinds of people who are heavy Reader users are going to be very active people online, very influential. But that is not a moonshot, big thinking type of project. It's an RSS reader. It was the best one, but it was just an RSS reader. Whereas if you look at something like Maps, they're not necessarily going to launch a new project as huge as Maps. But look at what they've done with Maps itself. The whole ground truth concept, basically creating a matrix, you know, the matrix inside this mapping thing, where they actually 3D map every inch of the Earth's surface in a way that gets high resolution the more people use it and the more activity there is around it. That is a huge undertaking that, you know, if somebody told me, you know, 15 years ago that somebody wanted to do what Google has actually already done, I'd say you're nuts. That's not just simply not conceivably possible.
It's true. It is true.
So happy birthday, Google.
Yeah, happy birthday, Google. Yes. I hope that Google can continue to build products that people need, you know, that people don't know that they need but do need desperately on the web, the way that they did with search. You know, I remember back in the day thinking, if you would have asked me before I started using Google, you know, in the early 2000s, do you need a new search engine? I would have been like, no, AltaVista's fine, Yahoo's fine, right? Until I started using Google and was like, oh, this is amazing, right? But, you know, I think in a lot of ways, like, people, users' needs, particularly like global internet users' needs, are maybe moving past or evolving to things in addition to web search. And I hope that Google can continue to deliver on those things. And so, and actually, Mike, this is kind of a controversial statement, especially with you here, because you make such good use of it. But, you know, a lot of people would say that Google Plus, which is, you know, Google's move into social, you know, looking at, I think, you know, the threats or what was going on with Facebook, and kind of coming with their own social product that, you know, maybe hasn't seen, I know, you kick me when I say this, hasn't seen the uptake maybe that, you know, that a Facebook or a Twitter has seen, hasn't seen that sort of hockey stick growth, hasn't gotten great reviews. And the way that they're integrating social across other products. I actually think that the way that they're integrating Google Plus across their products, particularly in communities that already existed like YouTube, is a really good thing. For everyone. And I think it's kind of happening slowly, and that there's some backlash, particularly when they're, you know, moving Google Plus into an existing community like YouTube, where people are used to their old tools and now they have to deal with a new tool. But it, you know, I don't, Google's never said this, but I don't know that Google Plus was, you know, maybe the instantaneous success or maybe the success that they wanted it to be right away. I don't know. You know, Mike, you've over 2 million encirclers. I don't even know what the term is, or followers, I guess, on Google Plus, and it's your primary writing tool, and you use it for everything, not just writing, but hangouts and all those things. And and you see the product as a huge success. I mean, you've said straight up that it's quantifiably the best social network out there.
Yes.
And that's why you spend your time on it. Do you find that your family and friends, though, are also there? Or did you find a new audience on Plus?
They are not there. And that is the single biggest problem with it, is that the thing that people do on Facebook, which is, you know, my old high school friends, my college friends, my family, my extended family, you know, my coworkers, my former coworkers, all on Facebook. And that activity of following what people are doing and sharing their lives, and it's all personal, and I know all those people, is very, very compelling to a huge number of people. And that's why, if you look at Facebook's the amount that people use it, it's huge. People spend hours and hours and hours on Facebook. It's a very, very compelling thing that's happening on Facebook. And to a certain extent, the reason for that is Facebook was the big social network at the moment when everybody got on social network. For a long time, social networking was, and Facebook itself was just college students. You know, originally it was just Harvard, then it was just Ivy League, then it was just colleges, then the high school kids came along. And then there was a point at which where, you know, those people's parents and grandparents and everybody got onto Facebook. And at that moment, it's like a game of musical chairs. There was one chair and everybody sat down on the Facebook chair. And now that Facebook has what I call a monopoly on everybody. Everybody's on Facebook because everybody's on Facebook. And that's the only reason everybody's on Facebook. And so, you know, for something like Google Plus to come along, Google Plus is many things that Facebook is not. But one of the things Google Plus is it's also a version, a type of Facebook. You know, one of its many hats that it wears is that it's Google's Facebook. And in that sense, it's really a lousy place to have that Facebook experience where you interact with everybody you know, because everybody you know isn't there. I mean, that's very clear. Now, is very interesting in this context. Two things that are interesting about it. Around the world, the whole Facebook thing is less of a phenomenon. Like, for example, in the Middle East, Africa, and a lot of other countries, the whole interact with your existing, the people you know, is not as important as meeting new people and interacting with those people. And so you see the high numbers on Google, and you're like, well, how could it be that high? Like, you know, and the reason is it's kind of more international. It's been more quickly accepted. And one of the reasons it's more accepted internationally is that Google has these programs where you can use Google Plus for free. You know, it's not counted against your minutes in India and other countries. A bunch of other reasons like that. But the problem is that for Facebook, and I'm predicting that Google will surpass Facebook in active users in about the end of next year. So in about, you know, a little more than a year from now. And that after that, Facebook will sort of slide into MySpace land. Part of the reason for that is that once Facebook loses this sort of like this is the only place where everybody is, they got nothing. They have nothing. They have a horrible interface. The ads are intrusive. The security is problematic. Nobody trusts them. They really have a lot working against them. And once they lose that monopoly on everybody, they're done. And whereas Google Plus is very slowly gaining the monopoly on everybody. Kids are leaving Facebook because they're tired of being spied on and sort of interacting so much so publicly with their extended relatives. And so they're looking for the anonymous sources of social networking like Tumblr and so on. And Google Plus happens to be a fantastic place to do that kind of social networking as well. So I really believe in the long game for Google Plus. I think that, you know, within 3 years or 4 years, it'll pretty much be the only major all-purpose social network that matters. There'll be lots of little tiny ones. But I think that the changing of the guard is pretty much inevitable unless something crazy weird happens. But it's absolutely true that right now Facebook is a much better Facebook than Google Plus is. Google Plus is a better Twitter than Twitter, and I could go on and on with other social networks. It's a better Path than Path. But that thing with like the your high school friends, Facebook doesn't, Google Plus doesn't have that yet.
And right. It's also, I find it's easier to start with Google Plus, and Mike, you're a big, I follow your method of posting from Google Plus out to Facebook and Twitter. So thank you very much for that. But I find that it's a great place to start. You know, you post in Google Plus, things automatically, for me anyway, things automatically get posted to Facebook and Twitter. If people want to follow me there, they can, but I never go to Facebook or Twitter. You know, Gina, like when you and other people start talking about, oh, Twitter's, you know, doing this. Do you have this app? I'm like clueless, right? I use the web interface sometimes if someone, you know, retweets something I say or something like that. Maybe I want to see who that is. But I hardly ever go there. And right now I'm fairly comfortable having the separate worlds of like, you know, family and friends are on Facebook and everything else is kind of on Google Plus. It makes it really, it's in a nice container right now. I mean, it'll be great when they can come over, and luckily with Google Plus, the mechanisms are there to filter out or just look at this circle versus this circle and things like that. It makes it really easy. But right now I'm kind of comfortable. It's like, yeah, I go to Google Plus. I can, you know, follow all the discussions on Google, Android, open source, making stuff. And I don't really care where those people are coming from, whether they're friends, whether I know them. I'm just looking for interesting ideas at that point. And so we'll see. I mean, for me, the other thing about Google Plus is Google's done a very good job, it seems like, of tailoring the discussions that I see on my homepage so that it is the things I'm most interested in. Unlike Facebook, when I go to Facebook, it's a blah, like someone threw up all over the page. Here's all the stuff that everybody's talking about. But on Google Plus, it seems like they're doing a really good job tailoring the discussion to what I'm interested in.
And they have to do that because really Google is all about where it's all going. And Gina, you're a Google Glass user as I am, and you see that Google Glass and the coming Google Watch and wearable computing in general is going to be a whole different set of priorities and processes for social communication, where there has to be machine filtering, sorting, filtering, whatever. And you know that, like, once you start using Google Glass, Google Glass is basically the sort of mind meld between the user and Google Plus. I mean, Google Plus, you know, when you just say, okay, Glass, take a picture, and then hit share, off it goes to Google Plus. And then when there's a message, it sort of automatically comes in. Now, of course, there'll be apps for all the social networks and so on. But really, I think Google Glass is the first glimpse we have into the coming world where Google Plus is central, simply because it's the central place where you interact with all your Google stuff. And there's going to be further integration. We've had a recent integration with YouTube. I think there'll be a point at which YouTube.com will just redirect you to Google Plus, and video and all that stuff will happen right in YouTube. I think we're coming very close to a point where bloggers on blogger.com, where there would be no distinction for those who use it between a public post on Google Plus and posting on their blog. In other words, you can post either on Blogger or Google Plus. And no matter which one you post on, it shows up in the other. It's the same set of comments, except on Blogger, you have your little design, and on Google Plus, you don't. You know, those kinds of deep integrations, it'll get to the point where, you know, it's just to use Google would be to use Google Plus. And it will be the best thing to use because of those integrations. So Google Plus as glue is a super compelling idea that Google is completely focused on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it is those services and those integrations. I use Google Plus because I have instant upload enabled on my Android device. The Android integration alone is huge. I sign in with Google a lot more because those buttons are just in my apps. I use instant upload. I want to embed comments on my blog, and I'm just going to use Google Plus because Google Plus has great commenting and threading. So even though I'm not necessarily going to plus.google.com and composing a post very often, I agree that those integrations and services around Google Plus are very compelling. I got to say, once I enabled instant upload, and it took me a while to do so, but once I enabled it, I take, you know, tons of pictures of my daughter and the baby all the time, and like all those auto features, the auto awesomes are so great. Like, I really see the value of that. Like, oh, okay, The problem, the reason why I don't actually write posts on Google Plus, and particularly like the way that you outline, Mike, of like doing a good post, you like get a great high res photo, use formatting like bold and italic, you know, include links, you know, make it kind of a compelling post. It looks a lot like a blog post. But see, the reason why I use social networks, I use Twitter particularly, is because I don't have to do any of that work, right? Like I can just type a few words and put a link and I'm done. And everyone's tweets are the same. I mean, you look at your Google Plus page and you've obviously put a lot of time and effort into finding images and writing the right teasers and creating headlines. And to me, I'm kind of like, well, why wouldn't I just do that on my own site? Like at one point, you know, it feels like a lot of work. It feels like more work. It doesn't feel as frictionless as, I guess, is the word that Zuck would use. Maybe some of the other places. But I think that's just a matter of, you know, I think that's just a matter of like what you're looking for, what you want to do. You know, if Google Plus is something like it just collects all the things I plus one and helps me do something useful with them, then fine. If it's a place where I'm just going to instant upload my photos and do cool things with them and then let me share the the friends and family that are on there. The thing about the friends and family not being on Google Plus, though, you know, Google Plus has a user acquisition problem. And like I hear that you're saying that people don't join Google Plus because their friends aren't there, but their friends aren't there because no one's joining Google Plus. I mean, it really is kind of a chicken and egg problem. And we've seen networks like Instagram and Snapchat and Path even have these like huge, you know, growth rates, you know, very quickly for small startups. Of course, we have different expectations for a big company like Google than we do for small startups. But we've seen, you know, huge, you know, user spikes happen very quickly. And that just didn't quite happen with Google Plus. So I think that there is a user acquisition problem. And I don't know if it's about the complexity. I don't know if there's too many different messages around what Google Plus is. Is it Hangouts? Is it comments? You know, what is it? But I do think that Google has some problems to solve there
there is a huge thing about expectations. I mean, Snoop Dogg is in more circles than Path has users. I mean, the scale
is totally different.
But the thing about you had mentioned, you know, the ability to toss off a quick Twitter thing, and just, you know, here's a snarky comment, off it goes. It's pretty inconsequential. And whereas when you do a Google Plus post, you think, oh, I'm stepping up to the microphone in this big room in front of people. Like, it feels like it's so public and it feels so consequential. The other part of that, of course, is on Twitter, it's trivial to monitor a feed. You can follow a huge number of people and everything's so short that, you know, whereas on Google Plus, you can really get bogged down with information overload because they can be such long posts. But I toss off all kinds of things. Like for every public post that, as you point out, is nicely formatted and all that kind of stuff, I'll probably post two or three privately to different groups, my family, friends, or whatever. And I just toss off whatever. I don't format anything. And I go all the way down to life logging. Where I post a lot of things that I don't share with anybody except myself, just to keep track of my own life. And Google Glass really facilitates that. Like with Google Glass, you're like, oh, here's a picture. I don't really want to share this with anybody, but I want to remember this moment. Boom, it's up there, done. I don't have to think about it. And so they mentioned at Google I.O. that for every post that's public, there are two that are not public. So lots and lots of people are using Google Plus. And you'd never know it because you're not, you know, unless you're in their private circle, you're not going to see their posts. And so it's got a creeping acceptance factor that I think is more than what appears at first. The other point I want to make is that I think that people have trouble understanding the actual magnitude of how much is posted there. I try to post things that are very timely. You know, if it's a bunch of people have posted something, some news or, you know, about some gadget or something like that, I'm not going to do another post. I might share or I might not. And so what I do before I post anything is I go and I search Google Plus to see, you know, get my finger on the pulse of how much this has already been posted. And in the first year or so, it was very often that, oh, nobody's posted on this. I'm going to be the first to post on this. Now that never happens. I'll have something that I think is the most bleeding edge information, and I'll do a search, and there's like 400 posts on it already. I mean, it's just if you look underneath the surface, there's so much activity on Google Plus. It's just monstrous.
Yeah. So,
and so, you have to, you know, part of it is the circle limitations. Like if you could circle 10,000 people, you know, it would just be completely overwhelming. But you know, it's, I think there's more going on than us tech pundits really realize.
Yeah, I think so too. In fact, like Cabo Zone and the IRC was saying that he couldn't be a photographer without Google Plus because of the interaction that he has there with other photographers. The communities aspect of Google Plus. He says he learns tips, tricks, hooking up with people for photo hunts or photo walks. You know, sounds like he really learned about photography from Google Plus because of the community and the way it's so easy to find other people that have the same opinions and things like that. So, it seems like just getting to your point of what you were saying, Mike, about the other aspects of Google Plus beyond just what you might see or what you might think, how you might think people are using it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, go ahead, Gina.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Okay. You had mentioned the benefit of easy auto uploading. You know, it's really worth doing. I mean, I think you were at Google. I know you were at last year's Google I/O. I'm pretty sure you were at this year's as well. I was too, when they rolled out all the photo magic stuff.
Yep.
That's one of those things that you really have to kind of pause and go, wow, this is just like beyond the sci-fi people didn't even predict this. I mean, it not only does the picture go up automatically, and then Google decides which are the best pictures and says, you know, you can look at all your pictures if you want, but here's the good ones, you know, which is kind of the mental process you do anyway when you take a gazillion pictures. And then it takes those and it puts little subtle, you know, essentially Photoshop improvements on them, which are always reversible. It does something like, you know, people talk about AutoAwesome and they always talk about the animated GIF, but AutoAwesome does several things. And one of the craziest things that it does, did this for me recently. I went to a family wedding, and at family weddings, everybody's posing, everybody lines up and smiles, right? And you take a picture, and, you know, and I have this really fast Canon, right? So I take, you know, 10 pictures as easily as I take one. And, you know, it was doing that thing where there's a picture that's the best picture, except one person was blinking. And so Google will create another picture, grab the open eyes from that person from another picture and put it in there so that you have one picture that never happened, where everybody's smiling, everybody's got their eyes open. And it just does that subtly. And so if you see a shot like that, that has the little like magic pixie dust logo, you know, icon thing in the corner of the picture, it's actually, I mean, this is just crazy that it does that. And it's all, this is like, this is before you touch anything, it's already doing that. It's just crazy.
It makes my photos delightful. Like if I go through my photos on my phone, I see a lot of blurry stuff. I see a lot of bad pictures and that one good picture. But if I go on Google Plus, and I think it defaults to just your highlights, so it always shows me my best pictures and the collages and the GIFs. And I didn't realize it was doing that open eye thing. I mean, I always am just like, oh yeah. Like I always feel happy looking at my photos. And that's all stuff that I would do if I had taken the time to do it, but it was always such a drag and I often didn't do it. That is the photo stuff really. They did hit a home run with that. And I don't think they get nearly as much credit.
And guess what, Gina? You're life logging. You know, you probably post only a minority of your photos publicly or even privately.
Yeah.
But those photos are there, and that's a visual diary of your life in reverse chronological order that is just priceless and private. You're actually life logging and probably never intended to.
Yeah, I think Google would have made a huge mistake if they had done something like, we're going to automatically share, you know, if you want to use the auto upload, like we're automatically going to post that, you know, in your to your circles or something, or to whoever's following you. I mean, I think that there was a moment there where I don't know if it was ever even thought about, but I mean, if they had done some of those things, like they take a very, when they develop a new feature, for the most part, it seems like they take a very good approach in that, hey, look, we're going to automatically update your photos, but we're not going to post those, make those public. You get to go in and choose which ones you want to make public, or choose which ones, you know, you can take off the autocorrect and the auto magic, whatever it is. It seems like they're making wise decisions, which I think is another thing that they seem to be doing well. The question I want to ask you guys, as long as we're on this topic, and then I want to hear about Hummingbird, because I think Gina mentioned that earlier. The question I want to ask you guys is, what's the prediction? Like, what would be the feature, or maybe it's not a feature, maybe it's something else, that puts, as far as the U.S. is concerned, at least, puts Google Plus over the top. Like, Mike, you mentioned in other countries, they make give you free access if you're coming in from a Google an Android operating system or something. I mean, what's that one feature? What do we think? What's the prediction?
That's easy. When Google really opens it up to developers and enables developers to build stuff based on Google for real, Google Plus for real, that's going to be killer. It's going to open up. It's going to launch 1,000 startups that are going to do crazy good stuff. I mean, it's crazy to think that to this day, Google Plus is not, you know, it's just pretty closed. I mean, there's developers are pretty much locked out. And I just think that's just going to be a singularity where everything changes.
Yeah, they've been pretty measured in the access that developers have. I mean, you certainly have like all the Google Play services things on Android have tight, you know, Google Plus integration. You have sign in with Google. But, you know, there's still the API, it's read only. And in fact, this was the question I was going to ask you guys earlier, is that, Aaron, you said something like, oh, Mike, I use your system for posting, starting on Google Plus, but then syndicating that out to Facebook and Twitter. I still don't know how to do that. Seems not obvious. Like, to me, the killer feature, and this is something that I feel like just won't happen because of licensing or political or competition reasons, is for these networks to talk to one another more freely. And for me to be able to, you know, very easily kind of, you know, post to all of them, but customize the message. You know, I don't want to do plus Mike Elgin on Twitter. That looks crazy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do at Mike Elgin, you know, at Elgin on, it just looks weird. And I hate when I see people kind of just clearly blindly like posting the same thing across, but I would like for it to be easier when I have something I want to share to be able to broadcast it to my networks in a way that makes it, you know, native to that network. I think every network has its own culture and its own, you know, ways of addressing other people and hashtags and things. Although we are starting to see some convergence across those things, right? We're seeing hashtags supported across all the networks now. But yes, better integration across these products and better access to these APIs. I mean, we're seeing things with Game Center too. I mean, Google is slowly opening up to developers and making Plus a platform with richer APIs. But it's been slow and it feels very measured. It feels very much like this is only what Google wants developers to do with this and nothing else.
They are so concerned. I think it's Vic Gandotra really who's behind this. He is so, intends to not blow it because I think Google blew it with Buzz, with a lot, you know, almost every prior social site. They screwed it up in some fundamental way. And I think Google is just, above all, they just don't want to screw it up. They know they have a great thing going and they just want to be very conservative and move forward very conservatively and just get it right. So I would like to see them move faster personally.
The privacy issue that you brought up, Aaron, about the default being not sharing. I mean, I think that, you know, Google learned some hard lessons, particularly around privacy when it came to Buzz, right? And when I instant upload 100 photos and I don't share any of those and they're just sitting on Google servers, that only costs Google money. Like, that's not, you know, like I'm not sharing that with anyone. I mean, they get information about me, right? Which makes me a little bit more valuable, right? Based on the photos. Now, I mean, we know that they know what is contained in the photos. They know if it's flowers or babies or chocolate or whatever. So they get more information about me. But if I'm not sharing to others, it's less valuable to them, right? But they made that decision that it should be private. And that was one of my first concerns about Glass, was like, when I take a picture, does this mean this is automatically going to go out to my circle? It's like, no, it's like, that's the right decision. And I think they learn those lessons with Buzz particularly.
Although that is so easy to do. Have you posted anything accidentally?
It's extremely easy to do.
You go share and it just starts happening and they give you like 3 seconds,
half a second to cancel.
It sometimes.
Yeah. Kevin Purdy showed his Glass to a friend of his who took a photo of himself looking in a mirror and then accidentally shared it. And the caption was, I think I just accidentally shared something.
I've shared twice a public post that said nothing except through Glass with a hashtag. Just by handling the Glass, just like by taking it out of my backpack or whatever and off it, you know, and then I find out later that I did the Google Glass equivalent of butt dialing.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, actually.
And they're often butt pictures because like, I will lay Glass down on a tabletop and sort of walk away and it's the waist level
upside
I'm
down.
Like, please
right?
don't auto share a picture of somebody's butt in my house, please, please, right. especially not mine. Please,
and don't generate a hashtag, please.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right, there's also that exactly. So I wanted to ask you guys real quick, unless it's really complicated. In summary, what do you guys are you using a particular tool to post across to post to Google Plus and then Facebook and Twitter, or is there a particular client, or are you doing copy and paste? Is there an extension? How are you doing it?
There are two tools that I think are extremely useful. One is Friends Plus Me. So I use Friends Plus Me to auto-post to Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And if you look at my Facebook stream with a mobile device, it looks perfect. It just looks like I posted on Facebook. If you look on the web, it's a funky, like, tiny little thumbnail thing, and it's not. But the whole post is there. And there's a link back to Google Plus, which is the most important thing to me because I want to have one conversation and right. not a bunch of conversations. Twitter is perfect, and except for this whole at and plus thing. I mean,
yeah.
But I do a headline, and then I do other stuff. Friends Plus Me takes the headline. It makes that the tweet and then puts a shortened link, which goes back to the full post on Google Plus. It's perfect. And LinkedIn is perfect. So Friends Plus Me is really, really good. And they now support groups. They now support groups on LinkedIn and Facebook. So you can do that flexibly. And then there's also something called DoShare, which is it's a little funky. And they're struggling against the fact that they don't have right API access to Google Plus. But it enables you to save posts and to schedule them. So you can have posts going out every hour or whatever on a schedule. It works 95% of the time beautifully. There's a couple little things you learn to deal with some of the idiosyncrasies of it. But that's another great tool for people who would like to do some of the things it can do. I used to use ManageFlitter, but Friends Plus Me is better for posting from Google Plus automatically to Twitter and Facebook. So I use Friends Plus Me.
And you said DoShare is it a Chrome plugin?
It's a Chrome plugin. Yes, exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah, it seems like these tools are sort of rapidly evolving, and mm-hmm. I figured that they're sort of the whatever you're using might be changing a little bit because things are changing, and it seems like you know to programmatically post something in the language of a particular network is kind of hard. But although I like the idea that it's just taking the headline and then shortening a link to your Google Plus post, and so you know that's the canonical location of the thing that you put up. I like that a lot.
Yeah. You can also generate, there are numerous tools for generating an RSS feed from your public posts. And once you have an RSS feed, you can, like, for example, I generate an email newsletter from my Google Plus posts. It's on hiatus right now, but I did it for about a year and something, and I'm going to be doing it again. But basically, that's pretty cool. I mean, once you have RSS, you can do lots of things with that. So that's another sort of, you know, all of these things are kind of workaroundish. You know, they're not exactly what you want, but, you know, they exist and they can be very, very helpful.
Yeah, I always still come back to that question of like, well, if I'm going to do all this work to make it work on Google Plus, why wouldn't I just write on my own site and my own domain, you know, using a tool that I own or, you know, data that I own and do this that way? But at the same time, like, I'm just not going to set up services. You know, it's the same reason why I use Gmail versus running my own IMAP server, you know, which I did for years, is like the time that I would have to spend to do the maintenance and have it work as well as Gmail does is just not worth it to me. And for something particularly like the photo stuff, you know, like I'm just not going to do all that stuff manually in Picasa. I'm not going to write the scripts, the software to do it myself, you know, for me automatically. So it's just easier. So I get it. But it does sound like, Mike, you spent a lot of time kind of working around and using different tools. I mean, you're definitely pushing the edge of the platform and kind of doing all the hacks that you need to do to make it work for you.
Yeah, I mean, the RSS thing, that took a bit of figuring out. It took me a day to figure that out a long time ago. And Friends Plus Me has to be set up. But in both of those cases, once it's set up, you're done. You don't touch it. You don't think about it. It just works, and you know, in perpetuity. There's just DoShare, you go in and interact with the site itself or the plugin itself every time. But you know, it can be worth it. But again, as you were implying, you know, for most people, you're gonna have a Google password. Like something is gonna like required yet. So you have a Google password, and you're probably going to want to do certain things in, of Google. So you're going to have a Google Plus account. Okay, you kind of have to have a Google Plus account almost for some people. And since you have a Google Plus account, you don't really need a Facebook account if you have these tools that auto-post. You know, it's not ideal to post through these things, but it's better than wasting your time on Facebook. And so it's really this is what Google is going to keep doing. They're going to keep adding these things. You know, they've already announced that Google Plus is going to be the social network for their whole new Android gaming universe.
Right.
Yep. And if that gets huge, then we're going to see, you know, so, you know, one by one, they're going to use Google Plus to be the basic social platform for all of the stuff that they do. So to use Google will be to use Google Plus. And since you're using Google Plus for one thing, you might as well use it for the other thing.
Right. I mean, they're clearly committed to it as a platform going forward. Yeah. Well, when they held that 15th birthday press event at the old garage, the original garage where the company started. And it made me a little nervous, you know, the homepage thing and the garage thing made me a little nervous because I think, you know, looking to the past and getting nostalgic is one thing. And I think that that's something that big companies kind of do a lot, especially when they're struggling with their big company-ness, is to sort of get nostalgic and sort of make, you know, kind of the old days, kind of this golden era or something. I'd much rather hear about what the future is. But happily, Google did make a lot of kind of small announcements about changes that they've made, particularly to search at that event. They have added in search results, particularly kind of sticking to the core product there. They've added comparisons and filters into the knowledge graph. So if you search for something like, this is the example they gave, you search for impressionist artists, you'll get this kind of banner across the top of the page, and then you can filter by different kinds of artists. So expressionist, cubist, modernist, realist, which is kind of nice. So it's like, this is, again, Google, if Jeff Jarvis was here, he would say that they're trying to intuit, you know, your intent. Another thing that you do, that they do knowledge graph comparison. So if you wanted to know what the fat content was of olive oil versus butter, if you search for olive oil versus butter, you would see, you know, the knowledge graph tables, which would normally show up on the right hand side, show up right there at the top of the search results and kind of compare the two. And Chad is bringing that up. Yeah, right there. Thanks, Chad. So you can see how many grams a fat or an olive oil versus butter, the number of calories, which is really nice. So Google's just trying to get really smart about what you're looking for. Also, continuing on a theme that they talked about at I/O is this idea that everybody uses different devices and that you should be able to get the same information across your devices, and the devices should kind of be aware of one another. The next couple of weeks, new version of the Google Search app is launching on iPhone and iPad, and so you'll get notifications across your devices. So if you do on your Nexus 7, if you say, okay, Google, you know, remind me to buy olive oil at Safeway, when you walk to the store with your iPhone, you'll get a push notification to get olive oil, which is really nice. And this is something that those of us who are using Android have had for a while. But now that it's on iOS, you can get the benefits across devices.
And you can see, Gina, in both of those cases, in both the cases of the knowledge-based comparison and of the sort of the information following you around on a device, these are very wearable computing-centric ideas, and it's all about your invisible friend. It's all about Google Voice Search, Google Now, and it's going to get to the point where you just talk and you don't care which device is listening. Is it your car? Is it your house? Is it your TV? Is it your phone? Is it your tablet? Is it your computer? Is it your watch? Is it your glass? You won't care. You just say, I want to know this information, or remind me to do XYZ. And it won't care which device. You won't care which device. And it won't care which device it tells you about the result later.
Right.
So it's really going to be this sort of invisible friend that is just ubiquitous, just ambient. And all of their search stuff is sort of being re-engineered to make that possible.
Yeah, and they're converging upon that one design, the very mobile touch friendly, the car design. Yeah, the Google Now car design, the glass design, which I imagine is going to be the watch design, which is a really great UI. It works across a lot of a lot of devices. So we're going to get that consistent, that nice consistent design. Hummingbird, which is the code name for the new search algorithm, like I said, rolled out like a month ago. And from what I understand, and Aaron, let me know if I don't get this right, Hummingbird basically lets you ask questions of Google, but it extrapolates what you mean by the previous query. So you could say something like, where is the Eiffel Tower and how tall is it? And it knows that it was referring to the Eiffel Tower and can give you those answers.
Yeah.
It's to answer kind of long questions or a line of questioning.
Right. So it's a line of questioning, and it's also about a more natural. So it kind of fits in with what we were just talking about, a more natural way to say these things instead of, you know, there's kind of like this secret code of, you know, people that are really good at making Google work for them know how to put the search in the search bar. And so I'll see like my kids doing searches and I'm like, no, put this word here and move this there and then put in this little, you know, minus this, and it'll get you exactly what you want. And, you know, and it seems magical, but, you know, not everyone knows how to do that. So I think it seems like what Google's trying to do with Hummingbird is make it a more natural conversation. And I think this also enables what they showed at Google I/O, where you can say, you know, drive, I forget what the example was there, but, you know, some lady was trying to drive somewhere and she, instead of saying like, you know, drive to this address, she was like, you know, take me home. It wasn't even like navigate or anything. It was just like, take me home. And it knew automatically to turn on navigation and to route her to wherever her home was. Right. And I think that's what this is trying to get to. So I think this is one step further in that, you know, nirvana that they anticipate, is that kind of like what Mike was saying, you know, you just talk out loud, kind of like the communicator from Star Trek, The Next Generation. You know, you've always got a device somewhere, whether it's attached to you or nearby, and you just say these things and it comes up. So it's there before you even have to go to a terminal or pull out your phone. You know, you pull out your phone, you turn it on, that information's already there in the drop-down pane or something like that. That's what it seems like they're getting at here.
Right, right. So it's almost kind of like, is the death of the search operator. I mean, you know, it's like phrase search and plus, you know, it's like salsa, but not the dance, you know, minus dance. You'd have to know all these special codes, right? But this is the smart Google, the Google that you can speak to as if it's another human, you know, and it understands what you mean in the context of what you've been talking about.
Context,
and it knows so much about who you are. Yeah, it knows, it has context and it knows who you are and what you're talking about.
Yep.
As I understand it, the new Translate algorithms are similar to this, in the sense that instead of trying to just like do this keyword thing and sort of, you know, just you said this word, so we're going to give you things that have that word in it. It's more like people who have all these other criteria have done something similar, and so that's going to influence what we're doing. That it's happening in Translate and so on. In fact, Amazon's recommendations have kind of operated on that general principle for a long, long time, where it's like, you know, give me a recommendation for a book, and they're like, well, we see that you bought this book, that book, and the other book, and other people who like those three books also like this fourth book, and so we're going to recommend this fourth book. You know, that kind of thinking about search, based on, you know, again, it's just massively big data applied to search in a much more holistic way. And I would like to say that there have been some critical, you know, snarky reports that Google turned this thing on and nobody noticed, as if it was so great, everybody would have noticed. But in fact, the fact that nobody noticed is precisely what's so great about it. Something like this is built... The information behind it, the stuff that makes it good, is built by the actions of users themselves. So like Maps, like Google Plus, like lots of these things, they essentially build the infrastructure, and then the actions of users make it good. And so the fact that they flipped a switch and went to this new system and it wasn't jarringly bad is almost a miracle. I mean, that's like amazing. And then as people use search more over the coming months, you're probably likely to see search get a lot smarter. And it's not something you're just going to notice right away. You know, the fact that you didn't notice that it was dramatically worse right away is quite a feat of engineering, and it's likely to get much better. This is a self-learning thing.
Yeah.
All search is. All search algorithms are. It's quality is robustness and the fidelity of it is determined by the actions of millions and billions of users.
Yep. Well, something that we might notice, Android Police, a great site. They do this. They do this awesome thing where they look at new APKs, new Android apps. They tear them down and they look at the source code and try to predict new features that are coming up. And they did this recently with the new Gmail release and found that it looks like from some XML files and some other code that ads are coming to Gmail on Android. And I'll be honest, I'm concerned about this. I haven't seen ads done really well in a mobile app by too many people. I think if anyone's positioned to do it, Google is positioned to do it. But I live in Gmail on Android. I process a lot of my email on my phone. And I'm wondering, you know, what this is going to look like. Is this going to be a banner ad at the bottom of the page? You know, obviously in Gmail, kind of in the browser, you have the keyword ads kind of showing up in the right-hand column, but you just don't have that kind of real estate on a touchscreen device. And I think it's really easy to accidentally tap on an ad when you meant to tap on a reply button or something else. So I'm really interested to see how Google does this, because I think that if they don't do it well, I think there'll be some backlash from users about, them kind of being an advertising company and affecting, you know, I think what's a really core experience to Android. Do you guys use Gmail on Android?
Yeah, I live in it as well. I've got multiple email accounts, and so they're all set up on my phone. So it's really easy for me to go back and forth amongst the four or five Gmail accounts that I have. Don't ask me why I do that. It's a long story. But, you know, I would hate to see – I'm looking at my phone right now. You're right about the real estate. I mean, they added those icons – not too long ago, which takes up some of the real estate from being able to see what the message is about. I wasn't too thrilled about that because most of the time it just displays like the first letter of the person's name.
I found the same thing.
I think it's stupid. I wish there was an option to turn that off. Anyway, and I'm afraid that the ads are going to end up in line, like you like three email messages and then an ad, which looks like an email message. I mean, that's my biggest fear is if that happens, oh man, that's going to be so disappointing. If it's a little black bar at the bottom or... The other option might be, you know how they added recently, they added the view where you can have social and promotions. And I think there's a couple other like that correspond to the tabs that you have in the web view. So that could be an option, too, where they have one that says ads for people that want to see them. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of where this because I got the new update and I'm not getting any ads yet. So that's good.
Yeah,
well, it's
no,
hard to imagine how this could be good. You know, it's like, well, they could just drop in the ads as if they're email messages, as they're doing in the browser version, and that sucks. Or they could just take up 1/3 of the screen, and that sucks. Or they could, you know, there's no good way to do that. However, having said that, the only way that this is going to be good is if the ads are so relevant and so desirable. Mm-hmm. That you want them no matter what form they come in. The problem with them is, you know, we assume that ads are going to be something we don't want. But if they can figure out how to use, you know, it's on a mobile device, if they can really finally figure out how to use location and context and what they know about you on other services to give you exactly what you to essentially give you search results before you do the search. That would be acceptable. Beyond that, it's not going to be popular, probably.
Right. So like, you know, in Gina's example of where she, in your example, Mike, of where you upload a photo, but you don't share it, and Google has maybe the location information, maybe you get an email message saying, hey, we realize you're at such and such, the corner of such and such intersection. By the way, this pizza place is giving you a free slice of pizza if you buy another one or something like that. And it would appear in Gmail as opposed to, because I may not have Maps open, but I'll get that notification if I get a new email message. So it could be good. It could be good in that sense. But I think, you're right. I'm trending more towards, this sounds like a disaster.
We see, Gina, that you're uploading a lot of pictures of a baby, and therefore you probably need a good stiff drink. Here's a bar around the corner.
That's right.
Don't go to the butt picture analogy, because then it gets all crazy.
It gets bad. So some of the strings that Android Police found in the XML were will not save add as message, will save add as message, add dismissed. So it looks like maybe, you know, dismissed makes me think that it'll show up maybe as some sort of toast, or maybe, you know, I've sent a message on Gmail and it says message sent. By the way, you mentioned something about credit cards. Amex has a 10% discount going on. You just go dismiss, you know, whatever. You know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how they handle it. I hope that it's subtle and relevant and good. Better than I've seen most ads. I actually think Foursquare is the only mobile app I use that has done ads of promotions that don't bug me and have actually piqued my interest enough to take advantage. Like Amex had kind of a special thing going on with Foursquare. And now if you check into a place with Foursquare, it'll say like, welcome, you know, your friends so-and-so and so-and-so have been here. By the way, like save money on whatever, you know, to be some sort of like clearly marked ad. And it's just like, okay, dismiss. I would have seen that anyway. And it doesn't interrupt the user flow so much. It's just that email is so personal. And you know, the ads don't bother me in the web browser, but again, you know you've got so much space there. Moving into the physical world of receiving stuff, Google acquired BufferBox, which is a Y Combinator company that puts up kind of I guess they're little just mailboxes in public places like coffee shops and such, and so you can order from your favorite retailers and have them delivered to your BufferBox, and then you can go pick it up at your BufferBox. Well, it was a Canadian company, and I guess the BufferBoxes were only available in Toronto. Well, Google is expanding their pilot to San Francisco, and that's happening now. And it looks pretty cool. I'm not totally sure how different this is from just like having a private mailbox. And I know that Amazon has like an Amazon Locker service as well, which I think is kind of a similar thing. But the problem it's trying to solve is just like, hey, you're not home. You're at work and you had a package delivered. But this is a safe, secure place where a package can be delivered and you get a push notification when it has been.
Yeah. The difference between that and like a P.O. box or whatever is that if you don't have a package, you don't have an empty box. You just did for the duration of when you have a package. It's almost like putting your luggage at the train station and you take the key. And then when you go back to get your luggage, you leave the key in there and somebody else uses it later. And Amazon's locker service, this is clearly a response to Amazon's locker service, is not doing so well. I think they're out of a lot of 7-Elevens. 7-Eleven is one of the companies that's working with BufferBox to try this, but it just seems like a kind of a funky business for Google to be in. I just don't see this succeeding. Having said that, there is an interesting trend that I wrote about last weekend of everybody tests everything in San Francisco, and including Google on other things too. The Google's new delivery service, which just recently went into the Bay Area, started in San Francisco, but there's a long list of services you can only get in the city of San Francisco. And this BufferBox thing is when they tested another city, the second city is San Francisco. So San Francisco is always the first or the second city to get these cool services. And if you add them up, you're like, wow, man, I'm moving to San Francisco. This place, this is some cool stuff. Having said that, this looks weird. You know, there are a bunch of coffee shops and stuff. Who wants to pick up a package in a coffee shop?
Well, they had also launched a local shopping delivery service in San Francisco as well. So it sort of makes sense that these two things would be launched hand in hand. Aaron, have you tried any of these new services in SF? I guess Petaluma is not. You guys are a little far out.
Yeah, I'm too far from San Francisco to make use of this, and it really doesn't appeal to me. Maybe I'm not the target audience. I guess I'm. You know, it seems like. What are they going to do above and beyond what like the UPS store already does and things like that?
Right.
You know, I think what Mike said about maybe the time, more of a timeshare thing where you only pay for the time that they're holding a package for you. That kind of makes sense. They could compete in that angle, but I don't know. I mean, I was intrigued with the whole Amazon locker thing. I thought that was interesting. You know, I guess I'm more interested in improving delivery services so that I can get things faster. So if there's some way to use this and also get like same day shipping to these locations or something, I mean, that might be interesting, but I don't see that as being part of this. So.
Right. Yep. Let's see. What else do we have going on here? This is relevant also in lieu of the 15th anniversary. Pew survey says that 56% of internet users Google themselves. See, I have an excuse to Google myself often. We do it almost every week on the show just to try out new features. So it doesn't feel like too much of an ego indulgence. But yeah, that's more than half of adults. This is an article that reports Search Engine Land. And in fact, men search themselves 58% of the time, women 54% of the time. And they've got also further breakdown by race and age. Of course, the younger you are, the more likely you are to Google yourself. Education and household income. Kind of interesting. I mean, not unexpected. I guess we all are concerned about, you know, what people are seeing when they try to find information about us. And, you know, what information about us is out there. I'll admit I had a Google alert set up for my name there for a while. Like get an email whenever, you know, a new web page on the web showed up with my name in it. It was usually stuff that made me go like, oh, but it was mostly useful. I wonder if Google could offer more, you know, going into the kind of social part of it, like if Google could offer more and better tools. And I guess Google Plus really is the solution to this for sort of creating your presence online and managing it and making it, you know, putting yourself, you know, putting the content out there that you want people to see. And I guess that's exactly what Google Plus really is.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is reputation management, and there are a couple of reasons to do that. Like, if you're a professional like us, you know, you're sort of in the public sphere in some way, you want to see if somebody's out there trashing you, if somebody's committing libel or whatever, or if somebody's stealing your content or stealing your name. You know, that's all good to know. I think younger people are curious. I mean, there are lots and lots of people who they search their name and there's nothing but a Facebook,
right,
thumbnail picture of themselves, and that's all they're going to find. But, you know, when they do pop up, it's like pretty cool. So, you know, it's sign of the times, and why not? I mean, you'd mentioned, Gina, that you, I was curious about this, that you had a Google alert. Did you get rid of it?
Yeah, you know, I did wind up getting rid of it at some point because it didn't feel complete, and it only came once in a while. And I kind of went through an inbox purge where I was like just shutting down any, you know, as many emails that came to me automatically as possible. And I just felt like, you know what, I'll find these things as they come up or people will tell me about them. That's fine. And it did not feel complete. Google Alerts felt really good and timely. And I would get, you know, big digest really often a couple of years ago, but it seems like it's kind of gone downhill. I don't know if they're just not maintaining it enough or if it's just my searches weren't configured correctly. Do you still use Google Alerts?
I use it heavily. I mean, I have hundreds of alerts. I have a special folder in Gmail to receive them all, and once a day I try to slog through them. I get 150 or so a day or something on every imaginable topic. Have too many. Like one of the things I do is if I am introduced to a new concept and I want to learn more about that concept, I'll just set up, you know, just the news related to that concept. I guess one of the most recent ones is reshoring. There are companies that are like Apple that are bringing their manufacturing from China back to the US or whatever. Kind of curious, is that a trend? Is that not a trend? So I'll set up an alert. It'll throw me for a while and then I'll get sick of it and delete it. So I'm very fluid with it. I probably create alerts every single day and delete some every other day or something like that. And I certainly have the ego ones going, the ego searches going. I find it phenomenally useful. I also, my big tip that I give people about Google Alerts is that there are also Google Scholar Alerts, which is an entirely separate system that searches, scientific journals and stuff like that. So if you're interested in technology, so search engine technology, you want a Google alert searching the general press, and then you want another one with the same keywords searching the scholarly press, because there are a lot of papers that people are writing that are very instructive. But I love Google Alerts, and I'm scared to death they're going to kill it someday.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, actually. That might be a sad day for you.
Yes,
I haven't heard a whole lot about it in a while.
I'm really encouraged to see that this number of people Googling themselves, and I think it's really important. I mean, people might feel vain doing it, like, oh, I'm not going to Google myself. That's so vain. You really should, especially if you're in the job market or looking for a job or you know, people, for employers, that's probably one of the first things they do is do a Google search on your name, and you ought to know what's coming up. When I was looking for a job recently, I read a story about it, this guy who, there was someone with the same name as him who did some horrible things, and he was wondering why he kept getting turned down for all these jobs. And then he found out that there was this person with the same name that was doing all these crazy things, and people were thinking it was him. And he had a heck of a time trying to go through. I think he eventually did hire one of the reputation online places to fix this. I think they finally got it fixed. But I mean, you know, this poor guy was searching for like over a year trying to find a job, and he didn't realize this until later. So I think it's in everyone's best interest, whether you feel, you know, like you're like it's a good thing or not, you definitely ought to go do it just to see what pops up, because that's other people's view of you that may not know you very well.
And Google Alert is an efficient way to do it, because you don't have to go searching every week or whatever. You can just set it up and forget about it. And then if you pop up somewhere, it'll show up in your inbox and you can see what people are saying. And, you know, it's the sense that Alert is that that they had some problems for a while and they've got, it's gotten better again. But I could be completely wrong, and I'd be curious of what the experience is of people listening or in the chat room, whether it's gotten better for them. I get tons of stuff. I don't know if it's comprehensive, if there's things being missed or not. And I'd really love to know whether it's really getting everything.
Yeah, Aaron's your point about Googling yourself is, I was kind of joking about feeling like I had an excuse. It does feel vain and egotistical, but you are right. It really is useful to see, you know, it's like, you know, walking out of the house in the morning without kind of looking in the mirror. And it's sort of just a reality of today's world. And especially for young people who are looking for jobs or applying to go into schools, plenty of potential employers and even schools and stuff are looking at your, you know, what you look like online, and pity the folks with common names who get confused.
Well, people should realize that nowadays companies hire external consultancies whose specialty is to find out everything there is about you, to the point where they even friend you on Facebook or whatever, and do deep research to find out everything there is about you. They essentially profile you, label you, categorize you, and then go back to the prospective employer and say, okay, this person falls into the following three unemployable categories of party animal, whatever. And I mean, this is a very, very sophisticated new industry that's being embraced increasingly by companies. And even those that are not going pro with the big specialized consultancies are doing a version of that in-house, because it's simply so easy and so inexpensive to do. So yeah, you really have to know what they know about you if you're looking for a job.
Yep. All right, well, next up we're going to do the changelog. But before we get there, Leo has time traveled from the past to the future. To the present, to the, I don't know. He's time traveled to come say a word to us about our sponsor today, LegalZoom.
Hey, Jeff. Hey, Gina. Don't mind me. I'm somewhere in the middle of the Adriatic, but I came back just to tell you about LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but I think they're better. There's certain things, legal things, one needs to do in life, but you don't need to spend all that money on a lawyer for. Things like a last will and testament, incorporating your business, an LLC, trademarks, patents. LegalZoom can help you with these legal tasks at a much more affordable cost. You get the feeling of control, which is great, too. In fact, this is how we did our LLC here way back in 2005. And it was partly because I didn't want to spend the money. All right, it was entirely because I didn't want to spend the money. But I do love the idea that I see the whole process. I go through it step by step. I answer the questions. I think about it. And I get the document I want. I think there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot of pride with starting your own new business. If you don't protect it, you're going to regret it. I can just say that. You know, you're at risk of losing it. Worse, if you get sued, you're at risk of losing your personal assets. That's why you create an LLC or corporation to protect your personal assets, to limit liability. That's what it stands for, limited liability. So here's the deal. I want you to protect yourself. I want you to use LegalZoom.com. I want you to join the million business owners, actually over a million business owners like me, who have used LegalZoom in the last 12 years to help start their businesses. You'll save time. You'll save a pile of money on startup costs. And, you know, they don't mention this, but I really think the sense of control you get is great. By the way, you can get legal advice from LegalZoom. They have this is new. They didn't have this when I did it. They have the LegalZoom legal plan. They've got contracted relationships with attorneys in almost every state. You can see their profiles online, unedited customer reviews. They're pre-negotiated fees, so you know exactly what you're going to pay. So you can get an attorney to give you some answers, help you decide between an LLC or a Chapter S or a Chapter C, for instance. Get a DBA. You can even form a nonprofit, all just starting at $99 at LegalZoom.com. Wills, trusts, trademarks. I love LegalZoom. I think you will, too. I really feel like they're a company that is empowering people like me to live their dream, and I think that's so great. Try it today. LegalZoom.com. All I ask when you use it, just please let them know you heard about it on This Week in Google. Put Twig in the referral box, T-W-I-G, and as our thank you, we'll give you $10 off. How about that? LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code Twig. Back we go to This Week in Google.
And now, the changelog.
The Google changelog.
Oh, that just makes me so happy every single time. So we got a few different new things in the Googleverse this week, in addition to some of the things we talked about earlier, Hummingbird and the knowledge graph changes. Google's released a completely redesigned analytics app. That's a Google Analytics app for Android. Got a totally redesigned look and feel, ideal for tablets and phones. You can see that clean typography and the card design that we're seeing across all Google products. Google Analytics for Android now has new visualizations that automatically resize to fit your screen size and your orientation. It's got a slide navigation that mirrors Google Analytics on the web, quick access to reports, and specialized reporting for web and app views. So if you're a Google Analytics addict, you definitely want to get this update. Google also launches Web Designer. This is a visual tool for building interactive HTML5 sites and ads. This is a desktop app for Mac and Windows, and you can download it if you go to google.com/webdesigner, and it's available right now. Again, just Mac and Windows. And it, you know, I got really excited about this because I thought, oh, this is a web development tool where you can make, you know, websites that are super, you know, interactive HTML5. And then, as you can see in the demo that Chad is showing us, it's this really small part of the web, and it's actually, you can build sites with it, but it's actually built for making ads. It was developed to allow advertisers to easily create HTML5 ads for mobile and desktop. Until recently, Google argued advertisers didn't have the tools they needed to easily develop content fit for today's cross-screen experiences, and Web Designer wants to be that tool. You can also make whole sites with it, but you'll see, you know, in the demos, really it's about making banner ads and the standard ad sizes are kind of built right into it. Google's reverse image search is now available in Chrome by default, no extension needed. This is in Google Chrome 31 and above, I believe, and I don't have it yet, but it's rolling out over the next few weeks. You don't have to install an extension to reverse image search. You can right-click on an image, and there's an option in the menu now that says search Google for this image. So you do a reverse image search, and basically it lets you see content that's related to a specific image. So if you search for a picture of your favorite band, you'd see search results that include similar images of the band or web pages about the band or even sites that include the same picture. Of course, I call this the catfish feature. Catfish is that show about people who get into online relationships and like haven't met the other person. And this other person is, you know, usually like looks like a supermodel. And then, you know, they do a reverse image search and realize that they've like janked this image from somebody who's totally not them. Mm-hmm. So now Chrome makes it a lot easier to do that. What else? Oh, Google's rolling out the streamlined new colorful new design for Docs, Sheets, and Slides in Google Drive. This is just kind of a minor update, but it does look really nice. You'll see in the screenshot there, you'll notice each editor has a product icon displayed in the header, kind of bright color, and that doubles as a link back to all your files in Drive. And the header is more streamlined and compact, and so you can focus more on your content. It looks nice. I can see it here in the rundown here. We use Sheets for the Twig rundown. And finally, what we talked about earlier, the new search engine card UI for mobile search and the new iOS search app. that we talked about earlier, the 15th birthday, so that you get cross device notifications and the knowledge graph comparisons and filters all rolling out now, and Hummingbird as well, which has been rolled out for quite some time. So yeah, that's it. That's all I got. The changelog. Thanks, Chad.
Hey, Gina, did you guys cover last week? Maybe I missed it. The inclusion of the new apps icon when you go to Chrome, instead of having all your Chrome apps come up, like you have the little apps button.
We didn't actually. I think I may have mentioned it when it was in beta. Chrome is one of those things, because there's Canary and it's Canary and then the dev channel and then beta. I'm not even sure how many channels there are, but you can often kind of see new features coming from far away. But yeah, that little apps button in the upper left-hand corner of the Chrome, like right under the back button.
Right here.
Yeah, right there.
Chad's got my desktop. So now, instead of like having this was what used to come up when you open a new tab. It was like all your stuff. You can see I'm a big old-time arcade guy. But, you know, that's what used to come up, and it was kind of like, blah, here's all your apps on the page. And then I think what they decided to do now is, number one, they're bringing the Google search bar front and center, which is interesting. And then, you know, so you have the button for apps. And then the other thing, well, it's even showing me over here on the other side, Chad, welcome to the new way to find your favorite Google products. So you can open up the grid, and it automatically drops down, you know, the things that I use most often, which is really helpful if I just want to click, you know, on Drive without like going to a different page. I mean, it saves me a couple of clicks, but throughout the day, that actually adds up to quite a bit of time savings for me. So I can go right to YouTube, I can go right to Google Plus. So they've changed that around a little bit, and I really like it. The more I use it, at first I was like, oh, I'm not sure, just because I was used to the old way of doing things. And now it's like, wow, this makes so much sense. Why didn't they do this years ago? Because it really makes it more streamlined on the page, at least for me.
Yeah, I have to say, I did not mourn for the departure of the black bar. I think they called it the sandbar across the top. It's much cleaner. I like the white space a lot more. That grid of little boxes in Chrome, when I first saw it, I was like, ooh, hey, get out of my Chrome. I mean, the whole point of Chrome is that it's supposed to disappear. Like, the actual Chrome is supposed to disappear a little bit. But I've gotten used to it. I mean, this very cohesive design is really, and you mentioned this earlier, Aaron, like, this is Page. Like, this is Larry Page coming in and saying, Google is going to have a consistent design that shows up across all the products. And it's really nice to see that, you know, the cards and the good typography and the white space, and now you see the hamburger icon a lot, and now we're seeing this grid of the apps grid button. It's these visual signals that you're like, oh, that's what that is, and I can see that in all different contexts and still understand what it is. So I really like it. I've accepted it. I didn't love that I had a button added to my Chrome without adding it myself, but I'm good with it. Like, now that I can see them rolling it into the web products as well, I like it.
And they even have a new commercial, I don't know if you've seen it, that talks about Chrome. It's a commercial for Chrome, and it says, you know, mobile, tablet, TV, or mobile, tablet, laptop. I forget what it is, but it's like, you know, it's the same experience everywhere. So they're really pushing for that. And I think that's what this is all about, really, you know, making sure that the user interface is common across all the devices so that people feel comfortable using it the same way on you know, everywhere they interact with it.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good commercial. I'm definitely pushing us toward a multi-device world where you've got a computer and a tablet and a phone. And everyone has a computer and a tablet and a phone and eventually a watch and glasses. And that's totally normal. And you're not dismissing notifications across all of them, which is nice. Speaking of watches, the Galaxy Gear reviews landed today. I know this is a little far afield, but the Galaxy Gear is getting some bad reviews out there.
It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you tried it, Mike? Have you tried one?
I haven't, but it's I wrote about it when they first announced it and essentially declared it dead in the water. The whole point of the new version of the wearable computing movement is that suddenly wearable computing is wearable. Like, you know, watches and smartwatches and cell phone watches and stuff have been around for a long time. You could, you know, 10, 12 years ago, you could buy a watch that could make phone calls and that could take pictures and all that stuff. I had a camera watch, you know, in the year 2000. But they were horrible. They're huge. It's like a TV set lashed to your wrist. They're just gigantic, boxy, bulky thing. You know, and you know, most women could never wear a watch like this, except for ironically, or you know, as a geek statement, fashion statement. They're just awful, and so the promise of the new watch movement that you see with the fitness oriented watches, and also the idea that Apple's working on a curved glass smartwatch, is that they're going to be actually. You can wear them in public and not be a complete dork. And then along comes Samsung with this throwback device that's just a gigantic, boxy, bulky, ugly thing that is, I mean, it's just incomprehensible that they actually did this.
That only works with the Note 3 if you want to talk about
I mean, they're slowly rolling out compatibility with a few other phones. But, you know, it's like at the very least, support every phone that has Bluetooth. And then, you know, you'll get more than a dozen users. I mean, it's just an awful thing that they did. And the thing that bothers me about it is I've been a huge cheerleader for the wearable computing movement in general and the smartwatch movement in particular, and I've been saying, you know, it's coming, it's going to be fantastic. And then they come, everybody saying this thing, and the Qualcomm watch, which was not a serious effort either. They're acting like, okay, this is the smartwatch revolution that we've been talking about. No, this isn't the revolution. This is not. This is a throwback to the thing that we're going to bury with the revolution that hasn't actually started yet. So
what's Google going to, I mean, the rumor is Google's working on one of these watches too, right? So what do we think they're going to do differently that's going to make it something that we can actually use and want to use?
Google Now?
Yeah, certainly Now.
That's
I'm trying to
imagine
glass
now.
On my wrist. Yeah, glass on my wrist would be really, really great, right? Because I wouldn't have the dorky thing on my head, but I would get all the sort of nice benefits of Google Now kind of right there. And it's true, really, just Google Now running on my phone or my wrist would be, there's so many things that they'd have to hit. They have to hit great battery life. They have to hit wireless charging. They have to not try to do everything, you know, kind of, and do a few things really well. I think that there are opportunities to market the watch to certain groups, like building the Fit watch makes a lot of sense, right? Like fitness nuts, you know, parents who have to do things one-handed a lot, you know, people who are just kind of notification junkies or news junkies or people who want notifications without being, you know, doing that rude thing when they have to pull out their phone. They just have to articulate the message of what the product does really well. And the product has to be like simple and just, you know, just be something that, you know, that communicates its value so much that you just can't bear not to have one.
And I think opening it up for developers more as well.
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's gotta be pretty big, because it's not only about what Google can do, but you know, if you have the ecosystem and a developer is willing to spend the time to make an app that's really cool. I mean, Google doesn't know everything about this. Samsung doesn't know everything there is to know about this. Sony doesn't know. So, I mean, I think having a functional developer ecosystem for a product like this will be huge.
Well, Android's rich like notifications, like Android has great rich notifications built in already, like that iOS doesn't have, right? So if say for instance at Google I/O 2014, all the developers get watches and automatically your app's rich notifications appear on the watch and you're able to control your media or you know, you perform all the actions that you can perform in a rich notification right now, but do it on your watch, which isn't that, you know, difficult to imagine, right? Because those rich notifications do have minimal UIs, but do let you perform the most important actions, you know, with very little developer intervention. That would be amazing. So that would be a good start. Like, hey, your app's notifications work perfectly on our watches. And when they're dismissed on the watch, they're dismissed across every other device. So your user's not going to be annoyed by them when they look at them on all their other devices. That'll be awesome. But, you know, if they also give away, every developer gets a smartwatch at Google I/O 2014. Also, here's the SDK and here are a couple of extra cool things that you can do with it. Here are the sensors that the watch has that none of your other Android devices have. Then you get no place where you're like, hey, I can install, you know, apps for this.
Yep.
So a couple of things potential smartwatch. One of them is that I predicted, and I hope that the prediction is true, that the Google smartwatch will have the same aspect ratio as Google Glass, so that the user interface and the apps and everything can be just the same. Just as you said, Gina, that it's the same thing. So For those not familiar with the Google Glass interface, it's a breathtaking new idea for an interface. When it comes on, you see the current time, and that's the present. And as you scroll to the right, you go further back into the past. Everything that's happened, every event that's happened, every card that's happened in Google Glass in reverse chronological order. And if you go to the left, it's the future. It's the weather today and, you know, and so on. And you get the very end on the left and you get same. That's a perfect interface for a wristwatch. Perfect. And if they have the same aspect ratio, they can essentially just leverage everything that's been done with glass for the watch. So, okay, that's one point. The other point about Google and a wristwatch is that the cool things about the Moto X phone, the coolest things about it are the sort of low power mode and the fact that it's always listening to and always paying attention to location and orientation and movement and all that kind of stuff in the super low power mode. That technology was developed for a wristwatch, not for a phone. They developed that for the Motorola smartwatch. And so, you know, look at what Google already has to bring to a wristwatch. They have the Moto X technology, they have Google Now, and they have the Google Glass interface. That's all I want. That would be the greatest watch ever.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the stories in our rundown there, Google is set to release the GDK, the glassware development kit, to developers, which will let developers build native apps for glass. So it'd be really interesting if native apps for glass, if the glassware app store, which is also rumored or may have been confirmed to launch next year, if that would just all work on the watch as well. There was the Mirror API that they released early on, but it was limited. So it looks like the GDK will really let developers do more native stuff. So it's interesting that they're calling it the GDK or they're calling it the Glass. Like if the plans were to extend it to the watch, I'd almost kind of expect them to call it like the wearable, you know, DK or something instead of the GDK. But there's definitely a lot of potential there. It does seem like Google's really positioned to do a watch well, just because they've done the UI on Glass. I have to say, social, you know, all the other kind of blockers aside, the UI, the user interface is absolutely perfect. They nailed that better than I thought you could do. I had my doubts about how you could navigate on Glass, but it's really quite good.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Speaking of glass, I love this video. There, a firefighter had entered the If I Had Glass social media contest, and proposed that he would use glass to take pictures and take videos while fighting fires. And he just got his pair, and I think just last week, and I think this past weekend, he fought his first house fire using glass. And he said, you know, I'm concerned about the heat and the smoke affecting the you know, the hardware, but he got some amazing pictures, and you really can see how, particularly for something, a specialized job like firefighting or security, how glass is really kind of amazing to be able to take hands-free photos and video. Yeah, Chad, you've got the video going there. I don't know if you can get sound on that.
Took this video at an actual blaze.
Driver just handed me the nozzle. I was like, whoa, dude, he's going to run over me. And this is my visor on my helmet. It's just quick and easy to catch the picture.
Wood received Google Glass on a Friday. By Sunday, he was fighting a house fire.
This is just a defensive fire.
Straight, right there.
Y'all come over here.
Of course, his plan has an inherent risk. Will the technology be reliable?
My biggest concern is the heat and the smoke.
He believes Google will take notes and make adjustments for Glass's 2014 release.
I think the glass that we have today is going to be different than the glass that comes out as a consumer model next year.
The way Chief Wood sees it, this tool could stand the test of time.
You can take a picture, send a picture, make a phone call. I think it's the next step in the information revolution.
In Jones County, West
Yeah, pretty cool. So, you know, while I have my doubts about glass as a general kind of consumer product, I think for firefighters and surgeons and teachers and, you know, field guide leaders and those kinds of specialized, you know, factory workers, anything to do with like safety or education, I think there's, you know, huge potential there. That certainly trumps the, you know, maybe discomfort of having, you know, a head mounted camera on your face.
Yeah, because you can't interact with it, right? I mean, a lot of those, I know I have a friend who's a firefighter and he uses like a GoPro that he puts on his helmet, but you can't interact with that. You can capture for later use, but you can't interact right away and say, you know, take this picture, swipe, send it to whatever, you know, the chief or whoever's monitoring the situation, right? That's so much more useful. And, you know, I can see this Google taking this one step further and integrating it into helmets and things. I mean, why wouldn't you do that, right? Or for police officers, you know, integrating it into their uniform somehow so that you can have instantaneous, you know, feedback to somebody that's making decisions that needs a closer look at the situation.
Yep, absolutely.
Very cool.
So did you guys accidentally hang out someone who you were not trying to hang out with? Did you see the story? Just Google Hangouts / GTalk. So on any of your devices, I guess apparently there was a glitch that sent some chat messages to the wrong recipients, which is basically the worst bug that you can possibly have in an IM client.
This actually happened to me.
Yeah.
Oh, Chad, this happened to you?
Yes. So here's the bug is that it for me, it still sent a message to someone who was in my circles, but if I sent a message to someone who I expected it would only go to them, it actually went to a Hangout full of people. Luckily, it was just like a, hey, you there? And people were like, I'm not. What? Like, what are you talking about? You know? And yeah, really scary to the point of like, okay, I'm going to use Skype for the next few days to contact everyone. Yeah. Yeah, not
fun. So how did you realize that it went to a Hangout full of people? Did a bunch of people respond? Like, who are you? What?
But basically, it would show up if you could see it. Like, it was a weird bug where I use Trillion, and so I sent it through Trillion, and then when I went to Google Plus, I could see that there was a Hangout that I had spoken in. And I realized that the messages that I thought were going to the other friend were going to the Hangout and not to the friend that I was messaging with.
Oh, yeah. Weird Twilight Zone. That would have freaked me out. I'm going to use a word that I would never use with Jeff Jarvis on the show, which is that's creepy.
Yeah.
That's totally creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you imagine if I thought that I was talking to a family member and was maybe talking about family issues? I mean, there's so much that could go wrong. That
there's so many awkward things that could happen. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that it was an innocuous message.
Yeah.
Chat.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah.
Hey, you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm impressed that you saw it. Like, I don't know if you were on Trillion, so you just happened to check Plus.
You,
like,
you know, it's funny because I saw the article and I went, my friend never responded. And I went over to Google Plus. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So, wow. And so luckily I was a pretty savvy user and I caught it really fast. And right. I knew exactly where to look to see if I was exhibiting the issues, but yeah, not fun. Not fun.
Wow. I got to say, I love Hangouts and I've actually switched to the Hangouts app on my Android phone. I use it on the desktop. I mostly use the text, you know, the text chat. I'm talking about the text versus the video chat. And I really like it a lot, but that's a little scary. Apparently there's a Hangouts update rolling out, by the way, which will show availability statuses, a better organized contact list. And I'm not sure if that has actually been pushed out yet. I think Android Police listed a link to the APK.
I think it's in the process of being pushed out.
Yeah, it's stage rollout. And,
but they need there's a lot that needs to happen with Hangouts. It's so it's confusing to use. It's hard to tell what's going on and who's, you know, it's constantly interrupting people. But I think the most glaring problem with Hangouts is it support SMS yet.
Yep.
It's got to support SMS before anybody can really take it seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm waiting for the day when the Google Voice Hangouts integration gets announced. And also the weirdness about the way that it interacts with Google Talk with different clients and that the XMPP decisions that they made. I mean, there were some missteps there, I feel like. It needs to talk to everything, interact with everything, but particularly with SMS, right? Because SMS, that's what iMessage has over Hangouts at this point, right? Is the SMS integration. Yep. That's definitely a big deal.
I almost wish they would have waited on this one. I mean, they should have just held back until that stuff was working and they had the integration with voice. They had the integration certainly with SMS. I mean, it just seems like they should have waited just a little bit because now they've introduced confusion. Do I use GTalk? Do I use Hangouts? Do I use voice? Right. I don't know. Maybe I just use my phone's built-in SMS because that's what works. You know, and I think it's going to be a lot harder for them now to to get people to upgrade, or I don't know if it's an upgrade, but change to Hangouts, which is what they want, because they want to unify all this messaging, which is great. But they're just going to have a hard time doing that now, because now people are confused. It would have been so much better if they just would have waited 6 months or something till they were ready, hopefully, and released it at that time. But whatever.
The other problem is, and I don't know if this happens to you guys, but there's an incoming call or some kind of Hangout or something, and you can't find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that happen to you?
Yeah, I've had that happen before.
If I go to Gmail, maybe it'll appear, you know, and it's just so half-assed. It's just awful.
Yep.
Yeah, I did have that. I did get a notification of one on my Android phone, which I swiped away and then couldn't find it, the new one. And now I have this lingering paranoia of, like, did I miss one? Or was it just a double notification? Yeah. Oh, you're right. You're right. I have been using it. I do like it, but definitely does have some issues to work out, for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
See, do you guys see Steve Ballmer's tearful goodbye?
Tearful.
It was intense. Yeah. He was a big crying man. Yeah. Mike, you did a piece about why Microsoft should fire Bill Gates, actually.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, there are three investors. Reuters reported this yesterday, who are calling for Bill Gates to be removed as chairman, but left on the board. And they're especially concerned with his influence over the next CEO. So they don't want Gates to bring in another Ballmer. I mean, essentially, Ballmer, in my view, was a conspicuously incompetent CEO. I was going to use this information as my number of the week later on.
Oh,
but
sorry, I scooped you.
No, that's fine, because I also have a pick of the week, which I can use in that segment. But here's the number, $570 billion. If you look at the valuation of Microsoft when Steve Ballmer became CEO in the year 2000, it was roughly $620 billion, and it was close to a record, the record that they had achieved. When you adjust that for inflation, that would be about $850 billion. So adjusted for inflation, Microsoft was worth $850 billion in 1999-2000. And it's now worth $280 billion. So essentially, under Steve Ballmer's leadership, and it's really Bill Gates' leadership, Microsoft has lost $570 billion in value. So if anybody can think of a CEO who survived that long with that much loss of value, I'd love to hear it, because it's never happened. And I've always believed that Steve Ballmer, the reason he was promoted to CEO and the reason he survived all his failures was because he was Bill Gates' guy. He was loyal, mm-hmm. personally, to his former college buddy, Bill Gates. And so Bill Gates, everybody says Bill Gates is a genius and a visionary, and there's another argument that he's a moral person because he saved a lot of lives with his philanthropic organization, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and that's a separate issue. But if you just look at the ability for Microsoft to succeed in the future, and you look at the litany of failures that the the sort of Steve Ballmer, Bill Gates duo has committed, missing the internet in every possible way, missing search engines, failing with MSN, screwing up their lead with Internet Explorer. If you look at the failures in mobile with the Windows for Pens and the Origami project and the this whole tablet PC concept and the internet and mobile is everything that's been happening since Ballmer has been in charge, and they've not had a single success. Everything that they've done that's been good, like the Zune or like the Surface, has been way too late for them to succeed. Windows Phone. So they're either wrong or they're late on everything in the last 14 years. And so to swap out Ballmer for another Bill Gates pick, another Bill Gates loyalist, and to have Bill Gates even on the board, even as not chairman, he has enormous influence, is far beyond his ownership. He only owns 4.5% of Microsoft, and by the year 2018, he's going to own zero. He's got a staged automatic withdrawal, essentially, of sales of stock that will leave him with zero Microsoft stock in the year 2018. These three investors who are calling for him to be removed as chairman, just them alone represent a greater percentage of stock than Bill Gates. So this guy, Bill Gates, is essentially not a visionary. He's a dinosaur, and he's the wrong guy to be so influential over Microsoft. Microsoft has so much potential, but they're unable to take their brilliant research and put it into products. They're unable to foresee things coming, and they need a CEO who's really in charge of the company, who really has vision. And if Bill Gates is anywhere near the board, he's going to use his influence to continue this long string of abject failures, and the valuation of Microsoft is going to decline and decline and decline until they're just a footnote in history. And so I think Bill Gates should be kicked off the board.
Wow,
that's I like that. That's good opinion. We got Mike calling the end of Facebook and Microsoft here, folks. I think I'm gonna put a reminder on my calendar and check in a couple of years and see if this actually happens. Oh, but I love that. It's good reasoning.
But is it really Bill Gates? I mean, every time I hear Bill Gates talk, in fact, the more I hear him talk as he gets older, it seems like he still has a lot of these good ideas. But you know, he resigned from his position. I know he's still on the board, but I'm wondering if really Ballmer wasn't in the way. I mean, do you think that it really was? Do you think that getting rid of Gates really is the right decision? Or maybe now that Ballmer's gone, some of those really good ideas that Bill Gates maybe still has could actually be carried out?
Bill Gates is very good with technology and business, but he has absolutely no feel for human nature, and so he has he's tone deaf when it comes to users, when it comes to markets, when it comes to culture. And so he is kind of, in my view, the opposite of Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was never super technical, was never a software developer, hardware engineer, but really had an instinct for what would thrill users. And since 1999, when Steve Jobs, 1999 is the pivotal year when those two companies go in opposite directions. And Steve Jobs' keen insight into human nature without a lot of technical acumen, and Bill Gates had all the technical background without just tone deaf about, you know. Let me give you one example. I think you guys even talked about it recently on Twit or maybe last week's Twig or something like that. But the continued, if you look at the tiers of Windows, the different types and all this, it was peaked out at sort of Vista. To not understand that is just a horrible, unnecessary waste of consumer goodwill, to just confuse the pants off of your customers, and generate this sort of buyer's remorse. But you know, back to your point, I actually think Bill Gates was you can't argue with the fact that that Microsoft succeeded when Bill Gates was the CEO, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was a tyrant, like Steve Jobs. He knew how to dress somebody down, how to instill fear, and how to kick everybody's butt. And he was a hardcore workaholic, totally engaged in making Microsoft his one. As a board member, it's just his ideas and his influence. He's not engaged. He's not able to instill fear and loyalty and all this kind of stuff that he could as CEO. And so he's more of a problem or a barrier, I think, to Microsoft's success. I mean, if anybody thinks that Steve Ballmer ran Microsoft in a way that was counter to what Bill Gates wanted, I would be really surprised by that opinion. He was a Bill Gates loyalist all the way, and he was essentially running Microsoft on behalf of Bill Gates and largely guided by Bill Gates. And between the two of these guys, they just missed everything. And it's really unfortunate. Microsoft has enormous potential. The technology and the market position they have with Xbox, the fact that they own both PixelSense and also Perceptive Pixel, that's the future of desktop computing, is touch. And Microsoft owns most of the intellectual property, and they have the biggest lead. And they're on track again to completely squander their lead. You know, they need a visionary who's going to get this stuff to market and be a lot more Google-like by just getting this stuff to market and being more transparent as a company, and stop. They need to stop fighting internally and having these sort of silification and that is kind of like internal competition. And they need to scrap all that stuff and just move forward and be aggressive. And, I, you know, with Bill Gates, I just don't see how they can do it.
Maybe they're not. Maybe they're too big to do that, though. I can't see a company that big being able to spit stuff out that quickly and not have the competition. I mean, I came from, you know, I worked at Oracle for a number of years, and it was similar there, right? You've got all this internal competition and infighting and things. You've got different groups that are trying to gain mind share, and everything's being run by the top, by Larry Ellison. I mean, I think with Microsoft, it's kind of a similar problem right now. Is they're so big, they've got their hands in so many pies. It's hard to really deliver like you're saying, like they should, with something that's really innovative and really bring something to market before other people. I think that there's so many barriers in the way, not just with the leadership, but with the size of the company and the different groups. Like you say, I think it's going to be really hard for them to actually deliver on that with if they are going to continue to be a big monolithic company like they are now.
Yeah, I mean, that could be. But, you know, what would Larry do? I mean, if they're too big to succeed, then you need to cut a lot of underperforming. You know, what Microsoft has been doing all these years is instead of cutting underperforming properties as Google has been doing, mm-hmm. they've been hiding the lack of performance through accounting gimmicks. You know, how much is Bing losing? Well, that's hard to determine because they've buried that in these, you know, other divisions and so on. And so that's sort of been their... That's sort of an internal political ass covering kind of approach to these problems that's very antiquated and is not going to help you compete against the likes of Apple and Google in on the internet and in mobile technology and in, you know, the gadget sphere in general. I don't think Microsoft needs to be smaller in order to do what they need to do. What they really need to do is they need to use what remaining power and cash that they have to go and school Hollywood in who's in charge. They need to turn Xbox into the living room system and turn that into home automation and all this stuff. They've got everything in place. They need to execute on it, right? The other thing that they need to do is take this PixelSense stuff and the perceptive pixel stuff, the big desktop touch tablet things, and also Pen. In Microsoft's case, they have great research on Pen, combining touch and Pen together. And they need to get that into a sub-$5,000 consumer version as fast as possible and really own that market. Because if they don't do it, Apple's going to do it. And if Apple doesn't do it, Google's going to do it.
Yep.
And, you know, as it is now, Microsoft is years ahead, but they're not shipping anything. You know, they're keeping it, you know, it's for casinos and CNN, you know, for election night coverage. That's what they're using this stuff for. Small potatoes. They need to ship this thing. They need to have this thing at Best Buy. And if they can't turn that around in 12 months, they're going to repeat the you know what they did with Zune and with Surface. They're going to come with too little too late, and it's going to be another lost opportunity.
Right. Maybe they need to spin up a Skunkworks project or something similar to, you know, what Google's done with what is it, X Labs, and then from my own experience, what Sun did with when ZFS started to become hot and heavy, they took these guys and they said, hey, look, we got this new ZFS thing, we've got this D-Trace thing in Solaris. Why don't you D-Trace guys go off to San Francisco and get a loft somewhere, come up with something new and cool? And they came up with this great product for a while that was really catching on. It was really innovative at the time. And I won't comment on where it is now because of where I work. But it was the concept of taking something like this where you have a lead and then because of your size needing to pare down and get focus on it, turn it over to a Skunkworks project. I mean, that's what seems to make the most sense here. Why wouldn't they do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the research itself is something that Microsoft is very, very good at. They have killer research. But then when it's time to productize that research, the internal political divisions prevent them because nobody wants to compete against another division. What they're starting to do, they're just now starting to do jump on board to what Google started, which is that you compete with your partners. Google was the first major company to say, hey, our whole mobile operating system depends on these other companies making hardware. They're our partners. We do the software. They do the hardware. And then they bought Motorola. And it's like, you know what? We're going to compete directly against our partners, our users, or our, you know, the companies that sell this thing. And everybody's like, you can't do that. And Google's like, oh, watch us. You know, we're going to do it. And so now they're doing that. Now Microsoft's kind of doing that. Their purchase of Nokia and all that stuff. But they really need to embrace that concept. They need to stop being afraid to cannibalize themselves and their partners and just move forward with the most bleeding edge technology. It's a cultural issue. It's not about invention. And I don't think it's about execution. It's about politics. And it's about internal folk that just needs to be completely undermined by strong leadership that just drives the best technology out into the market, no matter who gets hurt. That's what Google would do, and that's what Microsoft needs to do.
Wow, fantastic discussion.
Good stuff.
One of the hardest things to do is change culture inside such a big company, and you do need strong leadership to do it. Great, Mike. Thank you. Cool. So I think we should start to wrap up. If you guys have any other stories you want to talk about, we'll take a break right now for Leah to tell us about Squarespace, our second sponsor today, and then we'll move on to our picks.
Hello, Googlers. Leo Laporte here. Actually, I'm not. I'm not here. But thanks to the miracle of technology, I can be here in this form, this evanescent form, to talk about Squarespace.com. I see so many people. I see people like Jeff and Gina and lots of other people struggling with their websites. We do it all the time. We'll go to a website, knock it off the air. And I think, you know, that's kind of a shame. I mean, you're getting the biggest plug of your life sometimes. And because we know that because so many people are going to your site, it's gone down. So all those people who would see what you're doing can't. That never happens with Squarespace. We have tried. In fact, try right now. Go to our Squarespace site. The Inside Twit blog is running on Squarespace, inside.twit.tv. Can't bring it down. Every one of you goes there all at once. Boom, boom, boom. Nope. That's because Squarespace does both hosting and the content management system. They're tightly integrated. Anthony explained this to me once, and I know, you know, the founder of Squarespace, Anthony Castellana, explained this. It has to do with, it's like the servers are virtualized and the software allows that. And so your site doesn't just live on one computer. It lives on the whole Squarespace cloud. When more bandwidth is needed, the cloud is there to, you know, put more bandwidth behind your site completely seamlessly. Stuff like that. I don't understand it. I just know it works. I know we cannot bring a Squarespace site down. It's more than that. I mean, it's very affordable. It starts at $8 a month for the annual plan. The unlimited plan is only 16 bucks a month, and that means unlimited bandwidth, unlimited sites, unlimited pages. You will never get a bill with the unlimited plan for bandwidth. So you get to be, you are the most popular site in the world. Your site doesn't go down, and you don't get a bandwidth bill. If you want to do commerce, 24 bucks a month with the annual plan. By the way, with any of these annual plans, they'll hook up your site. They'll give you a custom domain name for free, and they'll hook up your site. The commerce is amazing. If you want to sell something online, there is no better deal for e-commerce than Squarespace.com. Unlimited physical or digital goods. You could sell MP3s and CDs, for instance, or paintings and photographs or digital photography, whatever. They calculate taxes, shipping. You could do coupon codes. All of this is built in. They set you up with a merchant account. But Squarespace takes nothing. It's 24 bucks a month. That's it. I don't know of a better solution for e-commerce, frankly. I think this is the best out there. Every site is mobile ready, so that means your store works mobile as well as desktop. Look, you got to try it. It's free. Go to squarespace.com. Click the Get Started button. You can see all the templates, start designing, import all your content, or create a new site. And then if you decide to buy after the 2 weeks, you don't need to give them a credit card when you want to try it, so you know you can walk away. But if you decide to buy, just please use TWIG10 as the offer code. TWIG and the number 10, and you get 10% off. Kind of just our way of saying thank you for showing your support for This Week in Google and Squarespace. Squarespace.com. When you decide to buy, use the offer code TWIG10 to save 10%. Back we go to Jeff, Gina, and This Week in Google.
Google. Before we move on to our picks, that's a good one. Are there any other stories that you guys want to cover before we go on to our picks?
I saw this thing about the vending machine, the game vending machine that Google put in Japan.
yeah. So this is an Android-based, or it's an Android game vending machine. So how does this work?
Yeah, so it works with NFC. I guess you just go up to the machine and, like, hold your phone up to the game that you want to load, and it, like, automatically loads. But I think this only works in Japan. I can't see how this would work anywhere else, right? Because Japan, if you don't know, I mean, they've got a lot of vending machines there, so they're all over the place. You can buy all sorts of stuff through vending machines. And I guess the concept is you just come up with your phone. It has to be Android 4.0, and you have to have NFC. And you might see a game or something that you want to load on your phone, and so you just hold it up there. And if it's a pay service, you know, it uses Google Wallet to pay, or maybe you can use a credit card too. I didn't see that in the article, but I don't know. It's just a really interesting concept. I just cannot imagine this. I mean, why wouldn't you just use the phone?
Right. So it's a software vending machine.
Yeah.
So it's like the Play Store. It's a manifestation of the Play Store. The vending machine will give you a Nexus 4 for you to try it out, but you have to give the Nexus 4 back. So this is interesting. So if you just want to play a game, you could just be like, hey, give me a Nexus 4, load up a couple games and play for a bit, and then just give it back, like renting an Android phone.
Oh, that makes more sense. It makes a little more sense. I missed that part of the article. So they're actually, it drops out a Nexus 4 and you use it. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't make sense. So they're hoping it's kind of like the Redbox idea, right? Like you go up and pick a movie, it spits out a disc, but in this case, it's spitting out a Nexus 4.
Yeah. Is this at an airport? It seems like this would make sense at an airport, although I guess you wouldn't take it on the plane with you.
Right.
Because you have to get the phone back.
It says the machines are they're only there for a limited 10-day run. So they're testing this concept out, but I just can't imagine this working anywhere else. It's just kind of an interesting story. I thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, cool. All right, let's move on to our picks. Aaron, why don't we start with you? You've got something really interesting going on in the studio there. I've been chomping at the bit to see what's going on that extra monitor.
Right. I don't know if you guys have heard about this project. It came out a couple weeks ago. It's called Google Coder. And what it is actually is Google is kind of embracing Raspberry Pi. And all of this, everything around this is right up my alley. So I'm big into Google, big into open source, big into open hardware, which is why I love the Raspberry Pi. And what you may not know is I also really love new concepts around education, right? So things like Udacity and different ways for people to learn and easier ways for people to learn about things. So what Google did was they created this Google Coder, which is basically their a learning environment for people that want to learn how to develop web applications. So what you do is you take your Raspberry Pi, and I've got my Raspberry Pi sitting here at the desk next to me. I don't know if we have a shot of that, Chad. Oh, you can kind of see it. I don't want to mess it up, but it's right here. So I got my Raspberry Pi. I've got a Wi-Fi dongle connected to it, and I've got the Google Coder image loaded on the SD card that's in the Raspberry Pi. And when you boot this up, and I will switch to my browser now. When you boot this up, if you're running Mac or Linux, you should be able to automatically go to coder.local, and it should connect you automatically to the Raspberry Pi. If it doesn't, if you're like me and you're running Windows so that I can share my screen better, you need to find out the IP address. Anyway, so this is the first use, so it's telling me we need a password. So I'm just going to try this. It's going to be a live demo. Let's just see how this works. So I'm just going to put...
These always go smoothly.
They always go smoothly. So I'm going to put a password in here. And it's telling me it needs to contain a lowercase and at least two uppercase letters or numbers. Wow. Okay. So let's let me modify this and see if it works now. Okay. I'm waiting. Here it comes. Okay. So now it says enter your password to get coding. Hopefully I can remember what it is. So I'll put that on there. And here's what you get. So it's really googly. Number one, you can see the things that are popping up. It kind of gives you, click here to do this. You create a new app, click here to do this. The brilliant thing about this is it's very low cost. So I'm running this on my $25 Raspberry Pi. So basically for less than $50, you can get everything you need to get started coding web apps. So let's just try this out. Let's go ahead and say we want to test. They've got some preloaded apps here, so we could do eyeball. We'll click on eyeball, and you can see the eyeballs moving around when I move my cursor around. And the great thing about this is there's a little, it's probably hard to see on the thing, but there's a little tab over here on the side. And if we click on that, through the magic of television. It's taking a while to load. But basically what happens is when you click on that, you get the code that loads alongside the application, and you can start going in and modifying it. So you could modify the color of the eyeball. You could modify the way that it works by just doing some simple, you know, changing the script slightly. So it's helping you to learn. And so I think this is a really great project, and I wanted to bring it up because it's really combining all of these things with the ultimate goal of, you know, increasing someone's ability to go out and do something that they weren't able to do before. So I just think it's a really great use of all the code's open source. It's using open hardware. You know, it's a googly experience, if you'll pardon the expression. But they're trying to make it really simple to use and understand. It's very inexpensive. And at the end of the day, you can write your own web app. So anyway, that's Google Coder. And if you are interested in learning web applications, I would highly recommend going out and picking up a Raspberry Pi and trying it out for yourself.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Really cool. So it comes with Hello Coder, Eyeball, Space Rocks, and then you can make your own.
Yeah, and then you can make your own. And it walks you through. I was going to demo that as well, but for some reason it's not quite working. Of course, it's a live demo. It's not working. But it'll actually, you can do create a new app and it'll take you through. Okay, it starts out really simple. Like, what color do you want your app to be? And it looks a lot like the apps in the Chrome, in the browser, right? When you do a Chrome app, it looks very, very similar to that. And so it's just a really simple way. They're trying to make it simple. I love that they, again, this is kind of a pet project, right? But I love that they took the time to build on what Raspberry Pi was doing to make it really easy for people to learn to code. And, you know, maybe right now they're concentrated on web apps. Maybe that's not your thing. I hope that they develop this into other applications. So maybe Android development, or maybe, you know, learn how to code in Java or Python or something like that using, you know, a similar easy to use kind of approach like this. So, yeah, cool. I just think it's really cool. I hope they continue to do stuff like this.
Right on. It's a great platform, Raspberry Pi.
Yep.
Mike, what do you got for us?
All right. Well, I'm going to be talking about a hardware device that Sony announced a couple of months ago, I guess, and it now is apparently available. And I just love the concept of this. It has a terrible name. It's called the Smart Bluetooth Handset SBH52. That's right, folks, the SBH52, ask for it by name. What it is, essentially, is it's a little device, probably about roughly the size of an Apple TV remote control. It's very small, it connects with any Bluetooth-based device. If you have a Sony device or another device that has an NFC chip in it, you just tap it to pair it. Tap it against the phone. And what this does is it's got an FM radio built in. It's got a little tiny low-res screen. You can receive calls. You can answer it like a little Zoolander phone, right? What it does, it enables you to have a gigantic phablet in your backpack or your purse or whatever, or even, you know, 10 feet away. And when you get calls or want to listen to music or whatever, you can use this thing as if it were a little phone, but it's actually connected to your device. There are apps in the Play Store, according to Sony, that deliberately use this thing I consider it a wearable computer. It displays your text message and notifications. It's waterproof. It's just a weird, like, odd kind of thing that Sony came out with that I think deserves a lot more attention than it's getting. Oh, and as you can see from the screen, it clips on. It can clip. It can go to pocket. It can clip onto your coat, clip onto your, if you're working out, and so on. It's great for the gym because you can clip it on your clothes and listen to FM radio. Some gyms have the television sets in front of the treadmills have FM radio to convey the sound of the TVs. So it's just a really cool device, and it's a thing that enables you to have a phablet as your phone without having to pull this gigantic thing out of your backpack all the time and put it up against your head to talk on the phone. You can have this little tiny phone. You know, it's just a cool little device that I think is both part of the wearable computing movement, and it's also part of the phablet movement, because it enables you to use a phablet in a more practical way.
Yeah, it looks really cool. Headset and handset. So it's not like a Bluetooth headset, but it's kind of like an iPod mini, but you can talk in it. So you get your big screen, but you can just clip that to your jacket.
And you can plug your buds into it and clip it onto your shirt, and then your device can be in the backseat of the car or whatever, and you can interact, you know, on the phone and listen to music and all that stuff.
What's the price range on this?
I don't know, and they don't have it listed, and they don't have a link to. But they up until very recently, it said coming soon, and now it doesn't say coming soon. So I assume that this is purchasable, and I don't know the price. But I will. But if anybody's curious about this product, I'll be following up on Google Plus as soon as I find out this information.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like an Uber Bluetooth headset. I mean, I like the fact that it has the buttons. Looks like 60. Well, wait, that's not American
pounds. So it's like $80.
$80. Yeah. That's not bad for a Bluetooth headset. I just bought one yesterday. In fact, it was a version for the car. But you know, I like that they give you the play buttons and you know, whatever that Uber button does in the middle. I mean, that really. I don't know. I think there's a place for this, especially like you say, when you've got this huge thing that you don't always want to have to whip out every time you want to pause your music, or, you know, it really makes a lot of sense. So I think it's really cool.
It does. Yeah. It does like weird, strange, unexpected things. For example, it'll pair to two devices simultaneously. So if you have two phones, you can use this to answer both phones.
Wacky.
Weird stuff like that. Yeah.
Huh. Very cool. My tip this week is a pretty simple one. It's kind of a web development tip for people who like typography and notice typography on different web pages. This is a new feature in Chrome that is coming out on Chrome 31 Plus. So you can try it right now if you're on the dev channel or using Chrome Canary. If you come across a web page with a cool looking font, you want to know what the font is. Instead of going to what the font, which is usually what I do, you can just right click the text now in the new versions of Chrome, choose Inspect elements, and you switch to the computed tab down in the inspection panel, and you can scroll down and you'll see a summary of all the typefaces used for that element. And Paul Irish, great web developer, said that this works great. You'll see the typeface names for Google Web Fonts, Typekit, local fonts, at font face typefaces, Unicode glyphs, all kinds of interesting font sources. And again, this is built right into Chrome. You don't, no extension needed, no third-party service needed. And this is in the dev versions of Chrome. So cool way to discover new typefaces and see, you know, what that cool, you know, font is that's going on a page that you're interested in. Chrome Font Finder. And it just if you're a developer, you use Inspect Element all the time. So it's just down in the computed tab there.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I like when these kinds of things are built into the browser. So the Chrome really got two things: the search, reverse image search, built into the right click menu on images, and this typeface finder, which is really nice. Well, I think that's a wrap. Thank you both, Mike Elgin. Tell us where we can find you online and hear more of your amazing insights about Google Plus and Microsoft and everything else.
Well, Google Plus, of course, and also Facebook.com/Mike.Elgin and Twitter.com/Mike Elgin Google Plus, you can just search for me there and find me. But really, Google Plus is the best place to follow me. And I welcome all circlers and followers.
Right on. Thank you so much for being on today. Aaron, tell us where you're at, where we can find you.
Well, I am one of those followers. I count myself as one of those who has Mike in my circles. And ditto for me. That's where I hang out as well, Google Plus. Follow me there. If you want to have a conversation with me or react to something I say or start a hangout or something, Google Plus is the place to be because that's where I do that. But you can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I'm there as well. So if that's where you reside most of the time, you can follow me there and you'll see all my stuff that gets cross-posted from Google Plus. But that's the best place to find me. And then you can also find me, of course, on many of your favorite shows here on the TWiT Network. Floss Weekly, All About Android Occasionally, of course, this wonderful show, This Week in Google Occasionally. So if you're wondering what I've done in the past or maybe you're not familiar with me, just do a search through the TWiT archives. You'll find me.
Right on. Chad, thank you so much, as usual, for doing a great job switching the show. Thank you. And you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/GinaTrapani. Next week, Leo will be back in the big chair. Jeff will be back. The whole band will be back together. And it's going to be good. We do the show every week on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. You should come and chat live and join us. And thank you so much to the chat room for helping us out today. And great show, everybody. Thanks again, guys.
You bet. Anytime.
Thank you.